You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the visionaries, and the big ideas in the food industry, where we dig deep and question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and I'm a gastronaut. Today's episode has been made in partnership with Kerry, and it's one in our series on the low alcohol and no alcohol sector. It's an incredible story, pretty much unstoppable rise. But what really excites me is the innovation that lies ahead in flavour and taste. As consumers are offered more choice, flavour and taste are becoming absolutely vital differentiators. But in this rapidly growing market, which ingredients and processes are delivering the best results? And which will bring in the next truly great drink? To try and answer that, we've gathered a fantastic group of tasteful and flavoursome experts. We have John Kelly, Senior Strategic Marketing Manager for Beverages at Kerry. Hello there, John.
Hello, Stefan.
We have Michelle Aubenel, Flavour Ingredients Global Development Director at Kerry. Hello there, Michelle.
Hello.
We have Danielle Becker, co-founder of Good Living Brew. Hello, Danielle.
Hi.
And lastly but not least, Craig Hutchinson, founder of a whole portfolio of non-alcoholic spirits. Hello, Craig.
Hi there.
Now, let's just start off by finding a bit more about all of you lot. So, John, for anyone who doesn't already know, can you tell us a little bit about Kerry?
Yes, definitely. So Kerry is one of the world's leading taste and nutrition companies. We supply taste and nutrition ingredient technologies and expertise to the world's leading food and beverage manufacturers and brand owners. We strive to deliver great taste and nutrition products that consumers really want to enjoy and help to create a world of sustainable nutrition.
Fantastic. Okay. Danielle, can you tell us about Good Living Brew and about the products that you make?
So at Good Living Brew, we make a category blurring product called Bionu Botanical, which has an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic version. And we call it the Wine Lover's Beer. I think that gives you a good indication how different it tastes. And in my previous life, I was Global Innovation Director for SAB Miller, so know the Kerry team relatively well. So yeah, it's a pleasure being here on the podcast with you.
Excellent, excellent. And Craig, you are a serial innovator in terms of no alcohol spirits. Tell us a little bit about Mindful Brands and a bit about the products that you have.
Sure. Well, we've got three brands on the market now. We've got Celtic Sol, a distilled dark spirit. We've got Marie Laveau, a distilled spice spirit. And then we've got M&C's, a CBD botanical spirit, so in the functional game. But before that, I'm the founder, along with my wife, of Cedars Alt Gin. And we launched midway through 2018 and very quickly became the second biggest brand in the no-low category. We established a great market here in the UK and then launched into 20 other countries and subsequently sold it to a major drinks player. So that kind of started us off, and we love it so much, a background in alcoholic drinks. So now we've carried on, and as I mentioned, a large pipeline of brands still coming through.
Fantastic. Okay, now John, most styles of drinks can be made with no or low alcohol, but some of them really lend themselves to it. Now, if we look at the market up to this point, how key has taste and flavour been, or has it, have other things been a little bit more important?
Great question, Stefan. So I suppose, you know, for any of us who actually drink, taste is the number one driver for consumer choice and repurchase. So it's absolutely critical to get this right, and it's particularly critical to help the growth and consumer acceptance of low and non-alcohol. And I think the great thing is for this industry and this conversation is the, you know, the range and quality of complex tastes and flavors is only getting better all the time. So low and non-alcoholic drinks are only improving. People want more flavors. They want better ingredients. They want traceability. And certainly flavor is something that we look into all the time. Every year we do a big report called the Kerry Global Taste Charts, and we look at flavor innovation and trends that are driving this. And there's lots of exciting flavors and sophisticated flavor profiles emerging in terms of innovation in the marketplace.
And what I really love is the fact that, you know, although the industry is new and it's beginning to mature, it's the ingredients companies that are having to mature to supply all of that. So I'm excited to find out what's evolving. But we'll come on to the detail of creating the flavours in a moment. But first, Danielle, how does the approach differ between developing a no or low alcohol drink compared to an alcoholic one?
I suppose the biggest difference to me is that, as we all know, alcohol does a lot for flavor carry. I think, you know, as you drink a product, a lot of what you experience taste-wise is actually retronasal, as the alcohol and all the flavors kind of hit the back of your nose, and you get this lovely warming flavor from the alcohol on your palate, and what that does for the body and the mouthfeel of the product. So if you strip all of that away, you've got to replace that with something which mimics that same mouthfeel that you would have in your mouth and can have the same complexity. Because I think what alcohol does is when you ferment or you brew a product, you're creating hundreds of compounds in that process at the sort of parts per million, parts per billion level. So when you're trying to recreate that, you have to try and mimic that complexity and still have an interesting tasting non-alcoholic product. So the challenges are quite different, because the things that we are used to which make products taste good, sugar, alcohol, and not in the alcohol space, but fat, all those sorts of things are not there for you as part of your levers to make this product taste good. So you've got to be a lot more innovative in terms of the way you create those products and things that you can use.
Do you think people making spirits, Danielle, have a slightly easier time starting off with ethanol?
100%.
Totally.
I mean, honestly, I even say that with our, because we sell both an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic. Mm. And when we launched the brands, I wanted to launch the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic at the same time. It took me another 18 months to get the non-alcoholic right, because it was that much more difficult to have a good tasting one. Basically, anyone can make a reasonable tasting alcohol product. It's not that difficult.
She said it. Okay, Craig, where do you think the balance lies in giving the consumer either a new taste experience, something that where they're going to go, wow, this is extraordinary and exciting, or a familiar taste experience where they say that's a bit like the alcohol that I drink and it'll do?
Yeah.
Is there a balance there, or are you just innovating and finding what is the best drink that you can create?
No, I think we need to do both. So non-alcoholic consuming adults deserve choice, right? Just like alcohol consuming adults have thousands of brands and products to choose from. So some will want a similar experience to an alcoholic drink. And just to remind, you know, it's not just about taste. I know we're talking about taste here, but it's also about the buying experience, the brand, the emotional side, and the serve. So yeah, for sure, we want to replicate taste experiences that adults know and love. But then some consumers, and we are seeing in terms of the stats, it is more the younger consumers are open to new taste experiences. But, you know, they've got to be sophisticated and multidimensional. With Danielle was mentioning, they have to have a mouthfeel along with the flavor. And then there's a third path, which is some consumers are looking for a different functional benefit to alcohol. So those are kind of the three. And, you know, you'd expect the replicating of the alcohol experience to be the first one. But let's not forget, it was Seedlip that came along first. And that was a kind of a new taste experience for adults.
And Celtic Soul, which is one of your newer brands, I mean, that's a dark looking drink. And I think what's really interesting to me there is that you've added colour to it. Now, I'm not sure if colour is an integral part of the ingredients that bring the flavour, but that is part of the deal, isn't it? You're pulling on various different sensory perception tools.
Yes.
And already, I mean, I look at the bottle of Celtic Soul and I'm imagining a different flavour from most of the drinks I've got. How important is it combining these interdisciplinary tools, the different sensory perceptions?
No, it's absolutely critical. So with Celtic Soul, we've tried to replicate an Irish whiskey experience. So, you know, and it's difficult to do that in neat, but if you mix it with ginger, you know, you're going to get very close to an Irish whiskey and ginger, especially if it's in the right glass and there's a little bit of a garnish and the right amount of ice. And so absolutely, it is a dark spirit, and that does come from the ingredients. We've got oak wood in there. We've got some caramel in there. And these are the type of flavors that you would find in Irish whiskey. And it does bring the color. And that's what adults are expecting.
Yeah, and that cross-modal sensory perception is really important, I think. It's really exciting as well.
If I could just add on to that, Stefan, I mean, when we used to do a lot of consumer research, especially with new product development, if you do it branded and unbranded, you get completely different results. So
expectations.
Yeah, so the brand that people will tell you is their favorite taste-wise, hand on heart, the best ever, is sometimes the one they like the least when it's unbranded. So it has to be a good tasting product, but it has to have that whole kind of experience, the serve, the branding, the bottle, the color, even how it looks in the glass, you know, what kind of foam or not does it have? So there's a whole picture that you have to look at, because consumers are judging that product as a package, not just on the taste, as though they were, you know, blindfolded or whatever the case may be.
And that's really interesting. Okay, so Michelle, let's go back to the chemistry of this, though. This is what I'm absolutely fascinated by. So ethanol, you know, as Danielle mentioned, this is a carrying tool. So ethanol is incredibly volatile as a substance. Is there something about the speed with which ethanol brings flavors to your nose or to your receptors that changes everything? And presumably it's very difficult to replicate that.
Yes, you're perfectly right. You have two receptors for the ethanol. You have a bitter receptor and you have a touch receptor. And at Kerry, we have decodified the ethanol in order to understand the three main attributes, which have been already explained by some of our colleagues. The bitter one, the cold one, and the warm one. So we have worked on the three avenues in order first to decode, to understand really the taste, not only the front taste, but also the long-lasting taste. Because one of the issues we have with some low-alcoholic beverage is a too long-lasting taste, for instance, of warmness, like capsaicin, or maltol, or menthol, or product like that. So you need to do a special sensory to be sure that you have the right profile that mimic the sensation, as said perfectly by Danielle and Craig, as when you drink, when you experience. So you want to drink, but you don't want to have the taste over the day. So we have been able to find out the three main attributes by decodification. And then from that, we create a range called the taste and sensation, which allow us to have building blocks by tonality. But I will say, as you say, ethanol is complex, and it will not be the same game as I have worked also with Sam Miller in the past, as you did for beer or for dark spirits or for white spirits. So you need to tailor make the solution.
That's fascinating, isn't it? Because that concept of the speed and the order within which the different flavors are perceived is really interesting. So is this an area where gas chromatography and mass spectrometry is really important, or is it actually less important compared to the volatility of different ingredients?
You have two type of product. You have the volatile, which is below, let's say, some product that you are used to smell. Like when you smell a rose, you smell some nice linalool or nerol. Or you have the long-lasting one, as the one you can find on hops or malt, which could be identified by LCMS, which stands for liquid chromatography. Mass spectrometry. So you need to work end-to-end with these two technology to understand the fingerprints. So when you have decodified, then you recodify. It's like a kid, you know. You blend your toys, the Rubik cube, and then you recreate. And that's fascinating for hers. But the idea I got some years ago was to go back to the roots. So I'm a guy that loved to go to the British Library in London. And I find really nice books from the Middle Ages where they were extracting either with water or with vinegar. So we have changed the game to do extraction with products that were used in the past, in the Middle Ages. And that's how we were able, step by step, to create a credibility in this product that will never be 100% the spirits, as said by Craig or Danielle, but will bring you up to the dream of the spirits.
And but to your point, Stefan, just so also you're building on your question around what you measure. So, I mean, we also, when you look at alcoholic versus non, you can look at the ester and higher alcohol profile of an alcoholic product. If you try and replicate that as is in the non-alcoholic product to try and mimic that, it tastes awful. So just the sheer presence of alcohol, you can't just try and copy the alcoholic profile and hope that by putting that in the end product, it's going to taste the same. So it gives you some clues, but the whole way the product hangs together is just so different that it's unfortunately not as simple as, you know, trying to copy or steal with pride.
Yeah, absolutely. But this is the complexity that I absolutely love. But I maybe love it more than the listener. So we better move on to some other things as well. Now, Michelle, do you think that flavorists should be trying to replicate any taste of ethanol, or should they just move on, understand how it works, and choose other ingredients?
I think we move on the two paths as a flavor, guys. We move on trying to replicate, for sure, and we move to a number of action like eliminated ethanol on whiskey or rum. So We are able to, from 800 liters of whiskey, we end up with 1 liter of a concentrate without ethanol and water. And we do this technology by coincidence in 30 years for Saudi Arabia already. So we have this kind of product which are getting the taste without the alcohol. But meanwhile, as I said, we are obliged to think about, as perfectly said by Craig, think difference. One brief was, I want to have a dirty gin. You listen to me, dirty gin, a black gin. And I think that this gin won an award somewhere, John, just because we thought about using black lemon as an ingredient, which has never been used in beverage. So also bringing people to the dream, to something different, is also helping us to build on this new category. I'm a firm believer that both categories can work hand to hand. And on some bar, I saw bartender using a non-alcoholic spirits or bitter and the spirits. So it's also something interesting.
That is fascinating. When that moves it to a whole different level, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And let me add a...
Go for it.
You know, let's not forget that there are other moments like the shooter moment, you know, and if you're a non-alcoholic consumer, you know, like myself, I haven't drunk alcohol for 6 years. Doesn't mean I don't want to be involved in that shooter moment, whether it's tequila or something else. So then you do need some, you do need to give some burn or some mouthfeel. So we do need to develop, some things that are similar and some things that are different.
That's true.
And I think I was reading something very interesting recently around, everyone talks about dry January, and someone changed that to delicious January. And this is the month to actually get people to try sophisticated, low or non-alcoholic drinks. Because, you know, back to this conversation, so many people buy a beer or a spirit and say, I'm looking for the exact equivalent. That isn't always technically possible, but also people want to try new things. So I do like the thing of delicious January, of opening people's minds or perceptions to trying new flavors and tastes.
Hello there, only me. I just want to break into the conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out two others we've recently made on this same subject. Go to foodmatterslive.com and search Low and No. You'll get an episode about the role of functional ingredients in alcohol-free drinks and another looking at the future of the sector. Now, back to the chat. Okay, now I know there's a big difference between taste and smell, but how do you think of them conceptually when you're making a drink, and when you kind of combine concepts in flavour? Danielle, is there do you separate things? I mean, are you sniffing things? Are you then tasting them? Are you then combining them and going, ah, damn, it didn't work in the way that I thought it would? What's the balance to strike?
I mean, I suppose there's a couple of things. First of all, is that the way it smells matches the way it tastes. Because often you can have a disconnect when you're trying to create these non-alcoholic products. So it will smell extremely like a whiskey, but then it tastes like water or whatever. You know, so you must make sure that there's sort of harmony from that point of view. And I would just add on sniff test, taste test, and session test. So how well does it taste after, you know, whole glass rather than just a sip? And I would say you have to look at it as a whole, but then also consider each element to make sure it hangs together. So maybe the product that is best on a sniff test and a sip test is not the one that you ultimately go with because it doesn't perform as well on the session test.
And are these things covered in sensory testing when the product is tested? So that concept of longevity,
yes,
of drinking over the course of an hour, that is tested?
Yes. Less so for non-alcoholic products, I suppose, but certainly for alcoholic products, you might do an initial screen based primarily on the smell, a second screen looking at both and looking at can people even spot the difference, those sorts of taste testing, and then to have a look at, for the ones you like the most, how do they perform on a session test? Because obviously it becomes more and more expensive the more complicated these tests become.
Yeah, which is big for the small companies who are making waves in this area. Craig, with low and no alcohol, talk about the quality of ingredients for us. I mean, you're dealing with combinations of ingredients, but they are the most vital thing. As Daniel said, you're taking away the ethanol component. So, is quality the most important thing, and is this the area that leads to innovation?
Yeah, it absolutely is. If we don't get good quality ingredients, we just can't use them. We just can't make good quality products. So,
can you give some examples of how that might work? So, is it about stability? Is it about?
And it's about flavor, because certainly if you're trying to replicate an alcohol, every ingredient plays its role, and if you get a bad batch, you know, your blend is not going to deliver. You know, I compare blending of non-alcoholic distillates and flavors to like to baking. You need great products and your quantities need to be super precise. If our quantities are out by, you know, a few milliliters here and there, again, we won't get to the flavor profile we're looking for. And by the way, you also need then, you know, really, really skilled blenders to do this. And I've done it myself. You know, you got to go there and you know, you got to stir it slowly. And it's the way you combine them together. You don't want too much sugar. You don't want to overstir it. So, you know, there's a lot of skill that's involved in distilling these ingredients. And again, you know, we've got to do it all individually. So we've got 10 or 12 different botanical ingredients in our brands. These all have to be extracted, distilled, or blended individually.
So, Michelle, can you tell us a little bit about, I mean, I presume we're mainly talking about botanicals here. Is it issues with purity, strength, and conformity, reliability, stability? What are the most important issues in terms of ingredients?
In terms of ingredients, the trend that is actually going more and more is the provenance. That the issue I faced this year when there was some freezing. We had issue with Anjou pear in France or some special lemon or lime from Spain. So that's number one, because everybody is willing to have also, a nice wording of the product is selling. So they are looking for transparency, tracking of the product, and also regional provenance. Beside that, I am 100% with Craig and Danielle. When you do extraction and distillation, most of the time you need to start with products that are good enough. So you need to check them beforehand with various methods, either a kind of steeping as you can do for tea beforehand or not, in order to check the quality of your products. But you could also distill them together. What I saw interesting, for instance, if you distill pure the orris roots, it's cost you a nightmare, because you cannot do the batch you wish, because you need to start with something 200 kg, it will cost too much. So it's better to create some small keys, as we are doing in our carry groups, which could provide you a flower notes, something that is more peated or more floral, by blending various plants and distill them together. Because when you soak them and distill, chemicals are doing a kind of wedding together. So you have esterification, transesterification, as is done with the alcoholic domain. So we find out that it's also a way to have something more rounded compared to the non-alcoholic.
But also for consumers, the whole element of ingredients is becoming more and more important. People want provenance, as Michelle was saying. Quite near where Michelle lives and works, there's a lemon called a Menton lemon. I'm sure Michelle will say it in a much nicer French way than I can. But, you know, people are looking for ingredients that are locally sourced, and the whole area of sustainability, you know, and I think the low non-alcohol category has a real opportunity to differentiate itself from its alcohol equivalents, because they talk so much more. Craig, Daniel and Michelle talk about botanicals as ingredients, where they come from, the provenance, the history, the sustainability. They're critically important, and they do influence people's choices. So if they're in a supermarket or a bar, they pick up the bottle, they look at the back of the label, they read the ingredients, they want to know where they come from. This does influence their choice. It's hugely important, and that's only going to get more important in the years ahead.
Yeah, so the story is
to take John's point. Sorry, Stefan. You know, we even want to know that all the farms use sustainable farming practices. And, you know, my direction or advice to all Nolo brands is that we have to have zero carbon debt, or at least be carbon neutral. And that starts with the botanicals. So I love what you said. This is a real differentiator factor, because the established alcohol brands cannot do that, but we can.
And Craig, I remember that was something 4 years ago, a group of young adults, I would say, the youngest was 16 from London, the oldest 22. Came to me and said, Michelle, I need some support because we have no cash, but we want to create a fabulous bitter notes with only sustainable products, organics, but tell me what you can deliver to me. So we spoke with manager, and we deliver 10 kg of each extract for them to deliver. And now I will not tell the brand, but they are doing quite well in the business 6 years after. So I love the magic of the young generation. They want to start from scratch, and they don't use the logic they had in the past. They say, The given is sustainable sourcing, and I don't want to have any issue with the carbon footprint. So tell me what I can use, and then I will create with my brain. So I love this logic also of the young generation.
So, John, I mean, what we're talking about here is I mean, they're different issues which you normally wouldn't talk about in innovation and flavors, but they are. These are different drivers of innovation than I guess we're used to. Do you think that it's taste that's the fundamental thing, or is the story that's being requested by new brands part of the innovation that's exciting?
It is, Stefan, and you know, when we get briefs in from our customers within Kerry, they say they have some flavour profiles in mind, some taste they have in mind. They want our input as well, which we give, but they also say sustainability, provenance, traceability is a critical element of that, because Craig was making the point earlier, you know, it's the whole package. It has to taste fantastic, otherwise someone's not going to buy it again, but it is the packaging, the brand story, the traceability, the whole element of it. And I think this is what's making this category so fascinating for consumers and attracting new consumers in, that there's lots of great things happening. It's a very exciting and vibrant category as well.
Mm. And Craig, so that's one thing, the story. But what about the different flavours that are around? Are there interesting combinations that have cropped up because you're searching in ways that people haven't been searching in the past?
Yeah, and, you know, thank goodness there were some, you know, really great conferences at the end of last year. So we're able to really get together as a category and see what the interesting flavor profiles coming through. And for me, the most exciting is functional, but functional with great multi-dimensional sophisticated taste. So you can't just now launch a functional mushroom brand or CBD brand that's going to taste rubbish or just taste like a soft drink or one dimensional. You've got to combine it with other botanicals and get your adult consumers on a taste journey. You know, something in the beginning and then something in the middle, and then, you know, a nice finish, whatever you're looking for. For me, that's what differentiates adult products, adult brands in the other space than if you're going into the refreshment or the sports or younger space. Sophistication, multidimensional.
So, Danielle, can you talk me through the gestation of a new drink? You know, do you start with sweet and sour, sugar and acid, and move on? Or is the starting point just everything these days because you just don't know what you might find?
No, I suppose actually, if you're designing a brand, I suppose the first thing you're probably going to think about is what is the problem you're trying to solve and who are you targeting? And start from that point of view rather than with the flavor profile, and then go and have a look at, well, what are they currently drinking, or, you know, what is it that your thing's trying to solve? So to the point, if you're solving Craig's problem of I want a non-alcoholic shooter that mimics the tequila, lemon and salt experience, then you would brief your flavor house to say, look, it's got to be, you know, really low pH, it's got to make my eyes water or whatever. whereas if you're targeting, let's say, like one of our brands, the sort of binary botanical, the non-alc, it's targeting wine drinkers, then it's going to say, well, I actually want a pH profile and a body and a aroma profile, which is much closer to a white wine. So it's probably starting more from that point of view. Unless you've got a very interesting botanical hanging about and it's got a particular interesting flavor, and then you might say, okay, well, how do I incorporate this into a product that tastes decent?
Yeah. So, Michelle, have you got any interesting botanicals hanging about?
We have a number. I just want to add on that sometimes in terms of brief we receive from the big guys or even the small older company is also a brief like a poem, like a story. I want to brief the smell of people on a horse close to this sea. So when you think about sea, we have extracted seaweed, you know, Dilisque seaweeds to have the taste of the sea. Then we have we went to the Pyrenees Alps and try to understand the smell of pine and weavers to extract these trees. But the more we go, and really I like that you smile about that, the more the brief, John, is something like a storyboard, and there's no border for me. Even the cost, they told me I don't care about the cost in use. I want to have something that will allow people to dream. And I will say that on this dreamer, we get some solid winner around the year in terms of gold medal or even platinum medal.
Also, the reason I'm laughing, I mean, honestly, I think flavor houses like yourselves, Kerry, are just phenomenal because sometimes the briefs that you get, you know, I want, exactly like you said, I want a product that when I drink it in my garden on a Friday, it makes me go, wow. You know?
Okay, let's get a specific now. Craig, let's talk about bitterness. Now, it's a very adult taste. It's a backbone of the drinks industry. Is it even more important when it comes to low in alcohol?
Yeah, I think Michelle mentioned freshness. Freshness and bitterness are totally adult drink fundamentals. You know, you want your drink to be moorish. You want people to you know, have another glass and another glass.
So maybe I can just jump in terms of bitter. As I said, it's part of the attributes, bitter, cold and warm. So you need to have the bitterness to have the sensation of alcohol. And bitter are more and more trendy. That was one of the first that we work on in order to create non-alcoholic products. So bitter are going hand to hand with the spirits. So, but you should not be one line bitter. You need to have not only the hops type bitter, you know, you need to have a bitter that could be the one that from the Nepal or some bitter that are mostly existing from Ethiopia. So you need to be like you play piano. You need to have a number of bitters. And then I asked Daniel, for instance, but Daniel, what kind of bitter you wish? So I can create various key of bitter, like the blue, the red, and the pink. And then we decide and we start like that.
It's a very good point.
And even within that, we're actually seeing more, I suppose, unusual flavors coming in that you wouldn't associate with alcohol. So you see, you know, obviously sweet is very classic, but you see heat coming in, you see savory coming in. Mm. And like Michelle was saying around the bitters. And even when you think of sweetness at times, you see, you know, white chocolates coming in and other things that are more, slightly more indulgent. So again, it's a great category for innovation. It's a great category for experimentation by consumers. And it kind of attracts a consumer base that maybe they might look at alcohols and say, standard gin, standard beers, standard vodkas, there's something more exciting going on here in low and non-alcohol.
Now let's look at adding a bit of layers of complexity and bring in concepts of flavour. Can we talk a little bit about Kerry's botanical collection Zero? Michelle, when you want to bring in intensity as well as authenticity, and I believe this is what you're aiming for with this range, are you asking a lot of flavour as a concept?
Yes, we ask for flavour as a concept because when you see product like cedar, I saw that on his armchair, you need to have the taste of cucumber, you need to have the taste of rose petal weavers without alcohol. And the key point is the request is 0.00 alcohol, not less than 0.5, which is most of the time. But now the challenge is no alcohol use at all. So the only way we find out on the first collection zero was to use pure water. And the idea, I need to be honest with you, I confess that I'm used to bring my solution at home and my wife was upset by my mess and she put everything in the fridge. So I discovered that dealing with the botanical, if you cool down the water-based solution that you could either or not modify the pH with a drop of juice of lemon weavers, you could extract better the product without using enzyme weavers. Then when you distill, you have not only the low but also long-lasting molecules. But the second step is our 2.0 collection just launched, where we extract with vinegar, a vinegar that is halal and kosher. So we end up with something with less than 2% acetic acid left over in the distillate. And this one brought you up to the long-lasting notes of this water base compared to the other one. So you don't need to use so much mouthfeel type molecules that are a little bit gummy in your mouth.
And presumably that changes the way that you mix a flavor. So once it's in the client's hands, does that make it simpler or is it just a different?
Yeah, the fact that with customer, what we do is that we create the standard keys as they are used to, with chemicals, natural chemicals and natural extract. And then we propose to add on this kind of magic products like Absolute or others to top notes and to go to the dimension they look on. For instance, on the new non-alcoholic cocoa type non-alcoholic beverage in China, we had a cocoa Absolute inside in order to twist the taste. And as said by John, get this kind of sweet and treat, you know, have a treat. So it's also not easy, but with the support of guys like Craig and Daniel, we can tweak and decide what direction we want to end up. Not only when you start drinking, but nearly at the end of your glass.
I love that. Okay. So, Danielle, with the production processes involved in low and no alcohol drinks, what are the game-changing tools? What are the things that have enabled flavour to really flourish? And is there an ingredient that you're still waiting for, that you're asking for and is just too difficult to produce as yet?
I can't think of an ingredient at the moment. I think the kind of warming ingredients, I feel like... for me, there's some more that could be done there. But I suppose the one I'd be holding out for is, I think non-alcoholic does give you a lot of opportunity to play in the functional space, which you could not do with an alcoholic product. But I suppose there are a lot of functional beverages that are being launched, which I would call pseudo-functional beverages, because they have a claim that they make relative to the base botanical, but actually they don't have any credible functional benefits in the final product. And I think if we want this category to grow and to see the shining lights come out, there should be credible functional beverages based in real science. And I don't think there's a lot of botanical ingredients yet that properly can do that for you in the beverage in terms of the amounts that you would have in the final product consumed by a consumer that have a credible functional benefit. And so for me, that's still an area that's growing and expanding. I mean, I think the actual flavors have improved so much over the last while that you can make a really good, even constructed non-alcoholic beverage that tastes really quite delicious. I mean, there's Freestyle, for example. Theirs is a made non-alcoholic and it's really, really good. It hasn't been brewed or had the alcohol removed or anything like that. And it's so... I think there's nothing stopping people from making now with the support of Kerry or, you know, equivalent to making a really good product.
Okay. So, John, let's look ahead and see how you see taste and flavour evolving over the next few years. What's going to be the driver of change? Is it consumer expectations, scientific breakthroughs? Is it just more development of the concept of the story? What do you think is going to drive change?
Oh, I think it's all of those, Stefan. It's obviously the likes of Michelle and the whole technical geniuses that exist, not just in Kerry, but across the flavour industry, having great new flavours. That's driven by consumers being open to try things. You know, citrus isn't just orange anymore. It's orange blossom, or it's there's elderberry, or there's beetroot, or there's basil. There's different things coming in. There was a very interesting one. In Ireland, Heineken have a stout brand they launched last year called Ireland's Edge. Stout's big in Ireland, obviously, and they put a tea and basil extract into that to improve the flavour and give a new experience. So new taste experience, new flavours is obviously a big area. I think the second big one, we talked about it earlier, is the whole area of, I suppose, provenance with a conscience, the whole thing of traceability, the whole thing of sustainability is going to continue to drive the industry, particularly within the low and non-alcohol area. And the other area, I would say, Daniela called out, the move towards more functional beverages. Because what's very interesting is when you get into particularly the no alcohol, you can have, I take your point about botanicals, you have a healthy halo claim to it. You can decide, well, maybe I should add added fiber, or I should add an added protein, which can have an actual claim to it. There was a very interesting beer that was launched in the start of January by Corona. They launched a sunbrew beer and that had vitamin D in it because they were talking about, you know, the sun and vitamin D linked with the brand. But again, you know, there's a healthy halo and there's an actual hero bit of vitamins or proteins or fibers or probiotics. So it opens up new potential. And the very last thing I think that's going to drive the industry, if you take a broader view of lower alcohol, a lot of soft drinks companies are really interested in this area. So we've seen the likes of Coca-Cola, primarily in North America, but also in the UK and Europe as well, coming into the hard seltzer category, which in the scheme of spirits is a slightly lower piece. And then you see Pepsi, you know, they're talking about doing a lower alcohol version around Mountain Dew and Rockstar. So you're going to see a lot of big brewers and distillers in this area, a lot of great innovators like Craig and very much Daniela coming into this space. And you see some of the big soft drinks companies So all these people coming in, driving innovation, hugely exciting category.
Sorry, I might just add wine. I think still wine is kind of like the holy grail. Now, Danielle, I've tasted Binary before when we were doing the hard yard selling at Phoenix last year, and it's a fantastic product. But but it's more in it's a beer space. It's halfway between a wine and a beer. So you know, you've done something innovative and novel. But I think there's folk like myself that miss a wine for social occasions, a white wine, you know, for sandanas, a red wine to pair with a meal. And there's nothing really that delivers at the moment. But I know there's some fantastic thing going on, playing with yeast, nano emulsions, maybe combining with tea botanicals. So, you know, I think this is going to be a fascinating segment in the next few years.
You make such a good point, Craig. I should have said, because I think once you add a little bit of carbon dioxide, it just changes the non-alc wine so dramatically. So it's so much, if you can somehow get that right without having to carbonate it, it would be transformational. I agree with you.
Okay, well, Craig, you've already answered the final question I've got for all of you by default. So the final question is, what would you like to replicate, really? And I guess, Craig, a decent wine. Michelle, what is there something that you that so I know that not everything needs to be replicated, but is there something that's fascinating for you that you think, oh, I'd really like to crack that?
Yes, for me, one of my favorite drink is something that is called brandy in UK, but more in French, cognac. So this kind of old wine, and I am with Craig when we speak about wine, but it's a blend of various spirits and wine. And I have tried several times, even at home, to try to mix the taste of cognac without cognac, which is quite a challenge. So I'm still thinking about that, how to build that, to have the experience you have when you have this nice glass and you hit it a little bit with your hand and you have the full body in your mouth, which is a grape, but also the oak wood and all this fermentation type cross-fertilization that occur when it's done in a cellar. When you see really this old castle in France, they are special and they show you it's a reality. There's fermentation existing. So I think here there are three parties. There are the grape, there's the wine, there's the oak wood, and there's the fermentation, which is done exogenic after. So that's something that triggers my spirits now.
It's the way he says it. I'm aching for my drinks cabinet already. It's not fair. It's flipping January here. All right. John, tell us about a drink that you would like to replicate.
Yeah, bourbon. I suppose bourbon, obviously American style whiskey, but what's different about bourbon is the fact it's barrel aged. So it has that kind of big vanilla caramel notes to it. It's great for cocktails or have it by itself. So replicating that kind of barrel aging. I know Michelle is leading a great piece of work around a thing called alcohol absolutes, where we actually take the base alcohol and distill it down to it's kind of alcohol free. There's potential innovation around that, but a great bourbon, you know, that really tastes good would be mine, Stefan.
Okay, and Danielle?
Nothing that hasn't been covered already, to be honest. I think if all that was available, I'd be a happy lady.
But can I just mention that all of the flavors that we discussed, you'll probably find at the Offie, which is a non-alcoholic shop that's currently open, and there's over 80 brands. So I want to give them a little punt, and they're now open to the end of February. Please, Stefan, give them a bit of a shout out, and you know, doing plenty of sampling there, and plenty of sales. So this is working.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I think you've done that for us. Okay, John and Michelle from Kerry, Daniel Becker and Craig Hutchinson, thank you so much for joining me. It has been absolutely fascinating. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast brought to you by Food Matters Live. I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you did, there are plenty more like it. We've now published more than 200 editions of Table Talk, exploring the whole landscape of the food and the drinks industries. You can find them all at foodmatterslive.com. For example, if you go to the site and search Turning the Tide on Obesity, you'll find the episode on the UK government's obesity strategy, where we ask, are we too obsessed with targets? Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.